This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Hollywood loves a good story about a heroic and earnest young white teacher might single-handedly save an urban public school of poor black and brown kids by teaching them to fulfill their potential. But that fantasy is also what drives many well-meaning white teachers from privileged backgrounds to teach in poor schools around the country. Well, how well-equipped are they really, and do they end up hurting more than helping? My guest, Christopher Emden, has written a new book addressing these questions and exploring an innovative pedagogical approach that works. Emden is an associate professor in the Department of Mathematics, Science, and Technology at Teachers College, Columbia University, where he also serves as associate director of the Institute for Urban and Minority Education. He is the author of the new book, For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood, and the rest of y'all too, Reality, Pedagogy, and Urban Education. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, let's talk about what you see as problematic with the way in which how white folks teach in our schools today, particularly in large cities, particularly in cities with public schools that have mostly poor black and brown kids.
So, Sonali, the larger issue really at play is not the white teachers per se. It is the approach to teaching and learning that these white teachers who come into these urban spaces come with. It is the structures of traditional schooling that reinforce a very particular approach to teaching and learning. It is the larger sort of social dynamics within schools. It is media narratives about poor black and brown young people and their propensities for violence. It is the Hollywood narrative and what it says implicitly about what the requirements are for teaching young people of color. It is perceptions of the inherent violence and anti-academic identities of young folks of color. So those things all come together and then become affixed to the persona or the teaching approach of a lot of people who come to teach in urban spaces. And what happens is that when they get into these spaces, they're so laden with misperceptions or preconceptions that are flawed of urban youth of color. They're so imbued with narratives about the inherent violence and their inability to be academically successful that the way that they're interacted with in schools becomes problematic, which I argue over time impacts how they're successful academically. If you look back historically, there's a perception that this is an underclass who had no academic or intellectual value per se, and the intent of schooling is to allow them to be able to sort of have an education so they can be better than they instinctively are. Teachers are recruited based on this narrative of don't you care about having us less fortunate do better. There's this technical aspect, but there's also this implicit process of extracting out the culture of these populations as they learn. And if you heard that story, and I didn't mention that it was happening in the 1800s with indigenous or Native American populations in the United States, it would sound exactly like urban America 2016. So I begin with that historical backdrop so we are aware of the fact that this is a part of our collective history in America. It is also a model for teaching and learning that we've always used, and it makes no sense for us to identify the fact that that model was broken and did wrong by those communities and then reinforcing and doubling down on those same approaches in 2016. Another piece, a significant piece I try to highlight in the book of why we need to be able to make these connections is because if we collectively identify the fact that schooling has served as an oppressive process for people of color historically and in the contemporary, perhaps we can now start drawing connections amongst these populations to find out how we can collectively address a new approach to teaching and learning that is informed by Afrocentric traditions, that is informed by indigenous population traditions, that is informed by models like the Black Church. The idea here is that we just find new models rooted in a counter to the existing approach.
And so I want to get definitely to what you describe in your book as how teachers really can start to connect better with their students, and in doing so, actually maybe even learn together. But let's talk about something that I thought was very obvious. Honestly, when I first saw the cover of your book, the first thing that I thought of was, ooh, I wonder if this is going to be a takedown of Teach for America. Right. So let's talk about Teach for America. And for for those of our audience who isn't familiar with Teach for America, explain what this program is and why it sort of tends to embody. I know you say in your book that you're not wanting to totally like trash this program, but why is this kind of symptomatic or emblematic of some of these problems we're talking about?
Yeah, so in the book, I do address Teach for America, and I say, this is not about Teach for America per se. And the reason why I said that is because if Teach for America didn't exist as the organization it is right now, I make the argument that another organization would spring right back up. It would be, Teach for Urban America, and there are many or micro versions of Teach for America that exist all across the country. So what I didn't explicitly take down TFA, which is what a lot of people anticipated, I did critique the model of TFA and similar models. And Teach for America essentially is a program that recruits a lot of students from oftentimes, Ivy League or sort of larger humanities-based focused schools across the country, and recruits them to teach. These are oftentimes people who may not necessarily have an interest in education, or they didn't go to college to be an educator. They get recruited. They go through a training program, oftentimes a summer program, in some instances over the course of the academic year, but a really snapshot of what urban America is supposed to be is what the teachers get and how to teach effectively. And then the teachers go into the classrooms and teach. And Teach for America serves the purpose of really filling the teaching ranks in a lot of hard-to-staff schools across the country. So that's what the model is.
And of course, it's very idealistic, this idea that we can, we've got these privileged, educated white people who want to do well. We've got these underprivileged brown and black kids who could use the expertise. Why don't we just bring them together and watch the magic happening? And of course, that's not what happens. So let's talk about how you, in studying children and how children themselves within their context of their lives, of the often difficult lives they may be living in, but also their own cultural contexts, have different ways of learning and have ways that are much more suited to their own learning than someone from outside their community coming in and just stamping, one size fits all models on them. What did you learn from kids?
Yeah, I mean, I want to even just take one step back. You really, really hit home on such a powerful point, which is the problem with a very simplistic model for solving complex issues. And, whether we're talking about education or we're talking about politics or we're talking about, any phenomena that deals with the sort of like the marginalization of people of color from being able to sort of really actualize themselves in any spectrum across this country, and I would argue across the world, it's oftentimes this: I can get these folks to help these folks and it'll all be better. The issue with that is that the whole entire model becomes predicated on a perception that a certain population needs to be saved. A certain population is not just not privileged financially, but not privileged intellectually, not privileged as far as their output of the world. So the simple model actually is predicated on a maintaining of biases against certain populations. Just by virtue of saying, I want you to go out there and save these kids, it's implicitly saying that you are better than who they are, which is a very different model than us going in and making the world better, or going in and having allies to solve a complex issue. And so part of the major problem here is us using very simple problems to address complex issues and viewing the populations who you want to quote unquote help as not having any value or having any assets or having any opinions about a change the landscape of the issue. And that leads to the question you ask, which is, what am I learning? Well, what I learned is that the answers lie within the communities that we perceive as having the problems. We can describe the challenges of urban America, but in my book, I showcase the ways that young people of color in urban settings who are being pushed into the criminal justice system actually have complex-ish ideas about how to change teaching and learning that would have helped them to be successful. Models like hip hop will tell you very much about what you can do to teach a teacher how to engage an audience. When a rapper is saying, I'd like to dedicate this album, Biggie Smalls' first dedication on this album was, I want to dedicate this album to all the teachers who told me I wouldn't amount to anything. That is a signal. That is a sign that these communities are telling you that what they're getting out of the teaching and learning process is that they have no value. I would argue that no teacher probably told them, hey, Christopher Wallace, you're not going to amount to anything. It may have happened, but I doubt that that's the case. But when he's saying that I want to dedicate to all the teachers, plural, who told me I wouldn't amount to anything, he's addressing probably well-intended educators who went into that space with the intention of doing well, but through the fact that you are coming with this hubris and this fact that I need to be saved because I am less than, you are giving me a message that I lack value. And when you consistently over time tell me I lack value, I'm going to push back against the institution of education. So my take here, and what I really try to iron out in the book, is if we listen to these communities, we find a way forward. Will educators, white educators or any educator, be humble enough to understand that the system as we have it does not have the answers of saving young people of color?
And that really, I think, turns the whole idea of education on its head as well. The fact that teacher knows better, student is a blank slate on which to be written, teacher shapes student. And we do have this approach, even if we're teachers teaching in schools, in our own communities, we tend to have this approach. Whereas, of course, I think now more and more educators are realizing, people who are researching education are realizing that teachers are really better suited to be the sort of, you know, guides rather than the ones imparting knowledge. And tell us about, you have a chapter in your book entitled Co-Generative Dialogues.
Yes.
And I think that sort of hits at the heart of how one can begin to approach really being someone constructive within an environment of an urban classroom. What are co-generative dialogues? How does one develop them and then use them as a tool?
Yeah, well, this is an approach to teaching and learning I've been working on since I was a doctoral student, seems like forever ago. So, and you know, my advisor, Ken Tobin, and I just did some really fascinating work about what does it look like when you have a conversation with a young person about how they're feeling about the classroom and what will happen if you let them give you suggestions about how to do it better, and then you implement their suggestions. It's really a simple and basic construct. So, you know, what I do throughout the book is I try to give this history, and I try to tell narratives, and I try to give theory, but I also give practice. And so the co-gen or the co-gender dialogue is practice. It's essentially teaching the teacher how to identify students in the classroom who represent different groups ethnically, racially, or as far as how they engage in the classroom, and creating a space where the teacher engages with the student outside of the classroom, before students outside of the classroom, with a critique of the teacher's instruction, but not just an empty critique, but with a goal of co-generating a plan of action with the student about how to improve the teacher's practice. So the idea here is that you have this cyclic model of a feedback loop where kids are critiquing the instruction and then informing the instruction. And once that happens, the teacher ends up sort of being a malleable person who becomes, over time, shaped towards the type of student that the students need. You know, and this runs counter to a lot of ideas in education that you described before, because, you know, I come from the understanding that the teacher is the expert in content, but the student is the expert on delivering information to other young people. And that shifts the landscape.
So the learning happens between students as well.
Absolutely. It has to. Yeah. In the best case scenario, that happens. And so once the teacher recognizes that you just happen to know more about this one thing, but the students know more about a whole bunch of other things. They know more about their lives. They know more about the culture that they share. They know more about the slang. They know more about where you go after school every day. Then the teacher starts understanding that, hey, my content knowledge is a thin slice of all the massive knowledge that exists within this classroom space. And then if we are entering the classroom with exchanges, right? If I'm willing to learn about the culture of the student, and then they'll be more apt to learn about the content that I'm delivering, and then there's much more exchange, and with the much more exchange, the student's content knowledge increases exponentially. Otherwise, the teacher is throwing content at students who are holding on to culture. And so all we are breeding is cultural clashes, which will result in, you know, disengagement.
Right. Now, let's also talk about how these models can actually enter the classroom. These ideas can actually enter the classroom and how they can percolate within the STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. I mean, these are fields where people of color and women are sorely underrepresented. Silicon Valley, you know, is constantly critiqued for just having, you know, it's basically a white male dominated field. And yet this is a field of the future. These are fields of the future. These are fields that also offer young children who might be suited to this work a chance to explore, you know, real joys. I mean, my background is in physics and astronomy, so I remember being awakened by science and mathematics in a way that I can't even describe. But most kids, especially in our urban environments, don't have that spark or don't get the opportunity to get it.
Right. So here's an interesting thing. I'm going to share a little bit of a narrative with you that I actually haven't shared with anybody else who I've talked to about this book or my work yet.
All right. So we're going to call this an exclusive. I'm just warning you.
It certainly is. In many ways, it's an exclusive, right? You know, I come to this work in urban education from not at all being interested in education. In undergrad, I was a scientist. I triple majored. I was a physical anthropology, biology, and chemistry major. My master's degree is in natural sciences. I had a life carved out for myself to do scientific research because I found it intriguing once that magic happened when I was an undergrad. And I decided I was going to teach I'll teach in this gap year as I figure out what PhD program in the sciences I want to go into. And it really was like, let's just have some fun and go teach. And boy, did my life switch. Because I started realizing so quickly that I'm trying to give the kids all this content, all the science content. I'm thinking that they're going to love the discipline like I do. And they just pushed right back. And I kept saying to myself, but wait, guys, I'm Black. I'm from the Bronx. I'm teaching in the Bronx. You're Black and you're Latino too. You know, you should just love this thing just because. And that's what led me to write this book, because I started realizing that I was using such an inordinate amount of energy, I mean, sweating while I'm teaching, to share this passion for science, and the kids were just not connecting at all. And it was because they had gone through, by the time they got me in 11th or 12th grade, they had gone through 11 of 12 years of people telling them, this is not for you. They had gone through 11 and 12 years of opening up every science textbook and not seeing a face that looks like theirs. They've gone through every year when everybody's saying that science is for the best and brightest, while they concurrently tell them that you are not the best and brightest. So these kids are undergoing a severe psychological aversion to the disciplines that's not at all even remotely connected to their ability to do well in the subject or be awakened by it. That's what led me to write For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood. It was like seeing the fact that a majority of teachers in urban spaces across the United States are white. That number increases fivefold when you're talking about STEM disciplines. Also, in STEM disciplines, we have more white males than we do white females who are in the field writ large. So those complications of it being societally perceived as a white male discipline, being taught by white males or males writ large, while you're concurrently being told that it's for the best and brightest, and then being told by the world that you are not the best and brightest, those things are not about content per se. They're about psychology. They're about sociology. They're about understanding the landscape of teaching and learning in STEM fields. And that's why I focus on culture with my project, Science Genius, where kids are doing very things that are seemingly disconnected from science. I have kids writing rap songs about science, showcasing their science content knowledge. Young people writing poetry, creating podcasts about science, doing screenplays about science and science ideas. And the magic gets sparked. Once the magic is sparked and the interest is generated, they do the rigorous work on their own. But unless you do that first, unless you address the elephant in the room first, unless you talk about race, class, diversity, pedagogical strategies and their ineffectiveness, poverty, unless you talk about those things first, you're not going to get the kind of results you want in STEM.
So Chris, your book, how can it actually help white teachers? Because right now, we have lots of white teachers. The majority, as you said, are white teachers. Yeah. And they may be, you know, I may have some among my audience who are thinking, all right, fine, I take the critique. So now what can I do to actually help my kids in a real way and help myself be a better teacher? So do you see your book as a tool?
I think that's the most powerful piece of this work. I created this book with intentionality. Just to be clear, you know, I'm not just like Ivy League professor talking about teaching. I taught for over a decade in New York City public schools. I helped to start a New York City public school. I served as an administrator for a year in New York City public schools. I taught physics and chemistry in high school, taught math and science in middle school. So when I say I'm critiquing the system, in my book, I am offering suggestions. When we talk about reality pedagogy, we're talking about progenitive dialogues, which we talked about earlier. We're talking about models to have kids know how to teach their peers and themselves in the classroom. We're talking about how you give kids roles and responsibilities to ensure that they're culturally sort of connected to the classroom. I talk about this notion of curation, how you collect digital artifacts with the students so that you can learn more about their culture and about the teaching and learning process. I talk about context and how you use the context where kids are from in teaching. There's certain junctures in the book where it really turns from a problematizing of the landscape of urban education to almost like a instructional manual. So if you look through the book, you'll see, I'm like, first identify these kids, then you do this. So, you know, I think that, you know, a part of the issue in education is that you have folks who are talking about theory, they write a book about theory, they teach you about theory, and then you go to your ed course and you learn about theory and then you go home. Then there are folks who tell you amazing stories about what goes on in schools, and then you love the story and then you go home. And what I've done with this book is really connect it all. So you don't have to buy 30 books, one with great narratives, one with great theory, one with practical suggestions, you know, and then you're spending your whole entire life trying to pull it all together. You know, I believe the strength of the book is that I try to weave these things together in a really succinct way. And through this idea of reality pedagogy, give teachers a playbook while I inform them about the landscape of the field that they're embedded in.
And so, of course, the best pedagogical researchers learn by doing the right kind of research, watching how children learn best in their environment. And I want to thank you so much, Chris, for joining us today, and best of luck to you with your book.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure being here with you. And I just want to say thank you for the brilliant questions. And, I can't wait to keep following your amazing work. So thank you so much.
Thank you. My guest is Christopher Emden. He is an associate professor in the Department of Mathematics, Science, and Technology at Teachers College, Columbia University, where he also serves as associate director of the Institute for Urban and Minority Education. We've been discussing his new book, For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood, and the rest of y'all too, Reality, Pedagogy, and Urban Education. We're going to keep Christopher on for just a few more minutes, and you can watch and listen to the extended interview on our website, risingupwithsonali.com. We've got a range of interviews in our premium content section that you can browse through. You can also watch all of the interviews that we've videotaped on that website. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. I'll see you next time.